Well, greetings, brethren. I wonder if we always realize just how beautiful this music is that my brother had composed for this church. I think perhaps a lot of the things in the early part of the church many of you don't realize, perhaps have not heard or been informed on. But when we first began the college, and we were raising up a new church here in Pasadena, a new local church, and we already had a couple of churches up in Oregon. They were very small, and no real minister to take care of them at all. And my brother had composed a piece that I heard him play, and it was very beautiful. And I had had the idea ever since I had been converted that in the congregation we should be singing the words that God Himself has given us. You know, the hymns that we had been singing were just regular hymnals that other churches use. And I noticed that they all seemed to sing the praises of the people. And if you get some of those books and read the words that go with many of those hymns composed by people having no knowledge of the Bible actually, they sing the praises of the people doing the singing. Whereas the psalms that God wrote, and psalms really mean songs, sing the praises of God and are meant for the worship of God. And so I asked my brother if he would devote his time to composing hymns for the church. And so he devoted the rest of his life for it. Now, I think there are about as many hymns that he composed that have not as yet been printed and that you have never heard as there are already in the book. And in due time, they will come along and we'll be learning new ones. However, we have a great many, even as it is, and hearing that number just played on with two violins and a piano made me realize when you hear just for the music and play it as special music, it is beautiful music. So I will say that much in my brother's memory. He died at the age of 80, and he had devoted the rest of his life from back about 1947 to composing the music that we all sing. Well, brethren, this afternoon is the last service in the first annual festival of the year. We have festivals three times a year, in the spring, in the summer, and in the fall. And we have the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread in the spring. And this is the second holy day at this time. I want to tell you a little later how we come to be observing these days. But first, I want to just say, do we really understand why we keep them? And do we understand this particular festival of the Feast of Unleavened Bread fully? You know, we have an entirely different situation today than they did in the days of Jesus and the first originals, first century apostles. I think that we have heard compared a number of times in some of the things that have been put on the motion picture screen for us, of the comparison of what those apostles had to confront, and how it is for the apostle today. And strangely, here's a much bigger world today, and many more people in the church than there were the first year or two in the church back there when they had 12 apostles. Of course, the number of apostles grew even then, but there were 12 at the beginning. And yet they had to go afoot or on horse or muleback or row a boat by hand, or sometimes they could use a sailboat at the whim of the winds. But today we have so many more people, and just one apostle today can carry the message out to millions more people than those 12 could do in those days. Today we have automobiles, we have the airplane, and we have the printing press. And today we are probably reaching somewhere around 20 to 25 million people through the printing press. And we are reaching, undoubtedly, much more than a million every week by television. How many people do you think who just happened to tune in and happened to listen to a program on television, and we're never on the best network stations or at the best time, how many out of 1,000 or out of 2,000 or 3,000 who listen do you think are going to go to the trouble of going to the telephone and calling in to request literature? One or two out of 1,000, perhaps, or out of 2,000 or 3. And yet here we're getting up 10, 12, 14, 17,000 telephone calls from one program. And that is not even half of the number of people that are writing in to subscribe for The Plain Truth or for other literature. There are still more that come in from newsstands and from other means, and we are reaching people by the millions. But there's one other difference between the way conditions were at that time and the way they are today. This is the festival teaching us to come out of sin. By putting leaven out of our houses, the idea is to teach us to put sin out of our lives. Well, there are more sins that have been getting into lives today than there were in the days of the early apostles. I wonder if you realize that. Now, they had all of the natural sins that we still have today, but there are more mechanisms today that increase the amount of sins, more opportunities for sin. With the motion picture and the automobile and all of the things that we have today, and the printing press. Now, Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days just before his second coming and his return to put an end to all of this kind of sin in this world and to bring in God's world, the world tomorrow, the kingdom of God. And certainly what he said was true. Sins have multiplied and increased, and there's so many more ways to sin. Now today, instead of coming out of sin in the world, it seems that the public media, not only newspapers and magazines, but radio, television, every means of reaching the people, are trying to show people how to sin and get away with it. In other words, how to avoid the penalty of sin, but not how to avoid the penalty by quitting sinning, by coming out of sin, but go ahead and sin, and then avoid the penalty. One of the greatest sins today, and it has been ever since, I think, the days of Adam and Eve. And one of the things that Satan is using against the world, perhaps even more than almost any other area of sin, is sex. I wonder if you ever stop to think, Satan has no sex. He cannot reproduce himself. And we have been given such a wonderful God-given opportunity to reproduce ourselves, to have a family relationship, a loving, pleasant, joyful family relationship. Satan and the angels cannot have that. Now, I think the angels rejoice, and their mission is to aid and service us who are the heirs of God's salvation and of His kingdom. And it is like the angels are a good deal like the nanny that, for example, the young, I think there are two young princes now in England, and there was a new one born not long ago. But the parents don't really take much care of them. They have a nanny to take care of the little kids. Or they have servants. Wealthy people have servants to look after the children. But when the child grows up, if he is the heir of a very wealthy father, then he will, of course, be in a much higher position than the servant. But while he's yet a child, the servant is over him. And so the angels are now higher than we are, and they're here to serve us. They're not only demons, and the demons are ruling this world because Satan is sitting on the throne of the world and not an angel. Satan is a former archangel, but he's sitting on the throne. But the holy angels are there to serve us. And I could tell you of a number of places, and as a matter of fact, I remember that I wrote that and added it in the book that I've been telling you about that is now complete, and I think unless we discover something else later that we want to update or alter or make an addition to or something, it's now complete and ready to send to the printers for final printing. And by the way, we are going to print the book in the Plain Truth serially. And the first issue will come out in about another month or so. I've already turned the copy over to the editors of the Plain Truth. And we have, of course, we have the whole book ready by now. But we hope to have the whole book ready before the Feast of Tabernacles. So it's ready to go to press and just as fast as they can get it printed from now on. But, well, I was going to mention something a minute ago. I think it slipped me now that I added into the book. Well, anyway, let me get along. I'm speaking without notes now, and I just have to say what comes to my mind. And it reminds me of the last two nights have been a movie on Channel 13 about Golda Meir. I wonder if some of you saw that. It was 2 hours each evening. It was a full 4-hour movie, or it's probably about 3 hours or a little more originally, but the commercials take out so much time on television. So it took two nights for it. And it concluded with the time when Anwar Sadat made the famous visit to Jerusalem to declare peace instead of war. And it showed them having some kind of a banquet. And President Sadat had made a speech and others. And finally, Mrs. Meir was going to have to make a speech. And someone sitting next to her said, "Well, have you thought about what you're going to say? Do you have something in mind to say? What are you going to say?" She turned and said, "Did you ever know me when I didn't have anything to say?" I couldn't help think about myself. Maybe I didn't have anything to say when I come out here, but I'll keep saying it nonetheless. But I knew Golda Meir, and I knew Anwar Sadat. And Anwar Sadat was a very courageous man to have made that visit. And I attributed, so far as you can attribute to carnal people that are not, that do not go by God's Holy Spirit, I attributed greatness to her. She was a very unusual woman, and so far as the natural mind goes, she said some of the very things to me that were said on this movie toward the end. And she said to me that she wished that the leaders of the Arab nations could all come and sit across the table from her. She said we could have peace. And she said our scientists and our technicians and our experts could teach them so many things to help them, and they could produce so much more out of their lands. And they could have so much more of the good things of the world. They could be happier, and we could all be happier. Now, I have visited many heads of state, but I have never heard anyone else say that about enemies. That was one of the things that I noticed. Well, there's one thing. There are more sins and more opportunities to sin today. And the whole effort is to make sin possible and to then avoid the penalty, to try to cheat God out of the penalty. Now, the wages of sin, finally, is death. And all the scientists and technicians in the world are never going to cheat God out of that. However, most of them are asleep at the switch and they don't know what they're doing. Jesus prayed on the cross, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." And really, I think that far more than 99% of the people in the world just know not what they're doing when they're sinning. There's so little of the right kind of education in this world. And their minds have not been open to the truth of God. Satan has blinded them. And almost more than any other one thing today is sex. Now they try to make it possible to enjoy illicit sex in a way that God never intended. And in so doing, they enjoy the beauty of sex as God intended in marriage. And then the production of children, lovely little children to come along. And the beautiful family relationship of real, genuine love. For temporary sensation. So today, they're beginning to find that what they sow, they reap. Now we have the new diseases now. AIDS, coming from homosexuality. So they try to justify homosexuality instead of trying to do away with it and teach it for what it is, they say, well, that's just his sexual preference. Well, indeed it is. And sin seems to be the preference of most people instead of righteousness. Do you ever think about what is your preference, brethren? Is it sin or is it righteousness? Because again, as I've mentioned before, let's see, was it in the sermonette this morning or was it the sermon this morning? I mean, sermonette this afternoon and the sermon this morning. Anyway, someone mentioned how I had said that sin is the absence of righteousness. That's precisely what it is. And righteousness brings so much peace and happiness and joy. And it is the absence of that which brings sorrow and suffering and pain and anguish, discouragement, frustration, remorse. And those consequences are not happy. They're not pleasant. And that's what the world is suffering. I think they say that, I heard a statement the other day, and don't remember the exact figure, but nobody who had AIDS a certain number of months ago, or a couple of years, or something like that, or three, is still alive today. They know of no cure. And yet they don't say, let's give up homosexuality and begin to obey God's laws. They say, no, let's break God's laws and let's try to find a way around it. And so the scientists now are trying desperately to find a cure for AIDS. Let people go ahead and break God's law. Let them bring on this disease. And then let us find some way to cheat God by a medicine that will cure it. And let me tell you, there is not a cure in 1,000 carloads or 1,000,000 freight carloads of medicines and drugs. There just isn't. There may be temporary relief. But you know, even the government won't let you put a cure in advertising any kind of medicine. You can say relief. You can't say cure. Then much in the news in the last couple of days has been another one that I frankly had not heard of, although I had written a textbook on the subject of sex. This is something that I think has come along since, and I had not heard of it. The IUD. I had a hard time remembering that because they want to use initials today. And they don't want to speak the whole words out. And I have to think it's I and U and then D. And a lot of women have been experimenting with that as a contraceptive. And they're finding that once she uses it now, in so many cases, it makes her barren. And some wives, in order to postpone another pregnancy for a year or two, have used this, and then they find they can never have another child when they want one. You can't cheat God's laws and get away with it, brethren. You cannot do it. I hope we have the sense to know that. The world does not have that kind of sense. They want to break God's laws and then use some means of a drug or a medicine or have science invent something that will let them sin and then avoid the penalty. They throw sex at you in every way today, on television. I think it was this morning there was a sermon. Yes. about turning on X-rated movies on television if you have the one of these additions to your television set that you can get now, so that you can have the rottenest kind of sex coming right into your living room. And a lot of people like to feast their eyes on something of that sort. Well, we were advised in the morning sermon against that sort of thing. Now, I thought it might be interesting this afternoon if you would know a little more about why you are here and how you came to know about these holy days. Here we are on a Friday. What are we doing here on a Friday anyway? The world will probably think we're crazy. I've explained some of this before, but I think I haven't explained what I'd like to say now in quite the same detail. I thought you might be interested in hearing about it. But I think it's pretty well known that I was challenged in the autumn of 1926, both on the subject of evolution and of the Sabbath day. My wife began to keep the Sabbath. To me, that was religious fanaticism. I had lost interest in church and religion since I had been 18 years of age. I was interested in business. And when I was challenged, I began to study evolution first. Now, it was quite convincing, many of the arguments, but there were a few little missing links that changed the whole complexion when I discovered them. Ultimately, I proved evolution is a false theory. I can absolutely, completely disprove evolution, and I have done it. And I've caused dyed-in-the-wool evolutionists to admit that I proved it. But they say, well, but they have to go on accepting it and believing it anyway because they've just been wedded to it for so long they wouldn't know how to live without believing in evolution. Well, that's the atheist's explanation of the presence of a creation without the supreme mind of a creator to have designed and thought out everything and brought it into being by a creation. Through a creator. So I began to wonder. I said, I always supposed that there is a God. I've been taught that ever since I was able to know anything, as I was taken to church from the time I was born. Now, maybe I'd been misled. Maybe they were right. Maybe there is no God. I said, I've got to have proof. Why do you believe there's a God? So many of you, brethren, have not really seen the proof. You've heard it and taken it for granted. There are a lot of people in the world that say, oh, I believe in God all right. Now, they don't believe God. He's no part of their lives. But they'll say, well, I believe there is a God. I believe God exists. That's what they mean. Well, they've never proved it. They've just heard it and taken it for granted. I couldn't take it for granted any longer. I had to know. And I was studying day and night and often up to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning till my wife would call out and say, are you ever coming to bed? You need to get some sleep. And I would be up early enough in the morning to get down to the library in Portland, Oregon, by 9 o'clock when it opened, and begin another day's study. And I proved the existence of God. And then I wanted to go further. Could I believe the Bible? I was going to go into the Quran and into the religious writings of other religions, but I said, I'll take the Bible first because it's the book out of which the Christian religion comes, and that's the religion of this country. Well, at first I thought the religion of Christianity came out of the Bible, but in my study I found that it doesn't. They try to read it into the Bible. But they're teaching precisely the opposite, the very antithesis of what the Bible says on most important things. They don't know what the gospel is. They don't know what salvation is. They don't know how you get it. They don't know what man is or why he is. They don't know who and what God is. No religion on earth knows. That's why I decided to write this book, The Mystery of the Ages. Who and what is God? Can you prove he exists? Why is it that people say, well, God isn't real to me? God just doesn't seem real. I've heard people say that. Well, we try to make it real as I can, in writing, in the book. There are many nations over in the East, in the Far East, that believe in evil spirits and various kinds of spirit gods and spirit worship. And people from thousands of years have believed things like that. Well, what about, are there spirits? Are there angels? Why? What are they? Why are they? Did God create a devil? That's a mystery. This book had to explain all that. Then man. You see, I was thinking in the summer of 1926, before this challenge came. I remember it so absolutely vividly, just as if it was only yesterday. I was trying to reason out. I suppose I was an immortal soul at that time. And I was trying to reason out, if I'm an immortal soul, now what will happen to me when I die? And just who and what am I? And you know, it got, the more I thought, and I tried to philosophize my way around it and tried to come to an answer, but it was a mystery. I couldn't understand it. But in the study that began that autumn in 1926, I finally found out what a man is, a human being. The Mystery of Man. That's chapter 3 in the book. And then the civilization that has come from man. How did it develop? A civilization that now in the 20th century has produced awesome results, going to the moon and back, the automobile, all the farm implements, most all have been invented either in the last part of the last 19th century or in this century, many in this century. Phenomenal progress, and yet people can't solve their own problems. Troubles are escalating. Problems seem unsolvable by human beings. Great minds that can produce great technological advances still cannot solve their problems in their own homes or with their next-door neighbor. We can't solve political problems. We can't solve economic and industrial problems, capital and labor, problems between nations, wars, everything wrong. How did this civilization develop? That's a mystery. Ancient Israel, why should there be a chosen people? Did God discriminate? Then why the church? Why is there a church? What is a church? Why is it? Is there any reason for it? Does it have a purpose? And what is it? The world doesn't know. The ministers of the churches don't know. And the whole message that God sent by Jesus Christ, his gospel, was the kingdom of God. And they don't know that, and the ministers don't preach it today. They preach a gospel about the person, about the messenger, But the message that he brought, they say nothing about. That finally comes to be chapter 7. And when we get through with that, that's only still the beginning. But in that study, I had proved the existence of God. Then I had absolutely proved to my own satisfaction, absolutely proved the authority of the Bible, that it is definitely the Word of God, the Creator God, that it is 100% true in its original writings. Of course, we have translations, and a few errors might have crept in here and there, but there's so many translations and there have been so many copies that we can get to the exact truth if we just have a little bit of patience and are willing to study a little bit. We don't need to be in doubt about any point. Now, in that study, finally, of course, I had proved that God exists. I had disposed of evolution, but I hadn't yet disposed of this Sabbath question. And I was reading everything that the Methodists and other people had for Sunday and against the Sabbath. Of course, I was reading what Seventh-day Adventists had and what the Sardis era of the Church of God had about the Sabbath. But I wasn't believing what they said necessarily. I was only using that as a guide to what was in the Bible and to see whether they had that correct. But the main point was, what does the Bible say? And I had finally come to the place where I was just about to accept the Sabbath, and that meant eating crow to me, because in a dispute as intense as this was, a man doesn't like to admit that his wife was right and he was wrong. But I was just about to accept it, and then I came across a booklet written by a dissenter from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, they have had dissenters from their church just the same as we have. And here was a dissenter who had written something to try to prove that the Adventists were wrong about the Sabbath. And he had, in this book, had gone through all of the passages in the Bible where the Sabbath, the monthly new moons, and the annual holy days were mentioned, and they're mentioned many times, all three of those mentioned together. And then he came to Colossians 2, verses 14 and 16, and he said, don't you see, there they are, and they're from the Old Testament, and that does away with the Sabbath. And I told my wife, I said, well, I was just about to accept the Sabbath, but I said, this knocks it all on the head. This is a former Seventh-day Adventist. And this shows that those days are done away, and it includes the weekly Sabbath as well. It says these holy days and new moons are all done away, and that means the Sabbath is done away with it. And my wife was worried sick. And when I told her that, she didn't sleep that night. She prayed all night long. And in the morning, by the time I awakened in the morning, she told me to go back to the library. And she said, I want to ask you one thing. I want you to do this before you make a final decision. I want you to go through Colossians 2 and verse 16 and look up every single word in the original Greek language and get the meaning. And you will see, she says, God has shown me through the night, and I know that there is a word there that has been mistranslated, and when you get that straightened out, it does not do away with the day. Well, I can't believe that, but I'll certainly go down and and look up these words in the original Greek language. So I got a Greek text, and I took the words one by one, and I looked up each Greek word in the lexicon, which gives the definition in the English language of each Greek word. And I finally came to a word, respect. Now, I want to take time to show you what it was, so I've asked Aaron Dean to come out and read a text. I can't bring a Bible and read it to you. Aaron?
Yes, sir.
You're there. Will you read Colossians 2:14 first?
Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross.
A handwriting of ordinances. Now, nailing it to the cross. The idea was that all this is nailed to the cross, and that meant that the Sabbath was nailed to the cross in the holy days. Now, it says in that verse, handwriting of ordinances. Oh, I thought it meant this, what Moses had, and that included the Sabbath and everything. Now, verse 16, if you will read it.
Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in respect of an holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath days.
Now, I get an echo over here. I didn't hear every word of it, but I know it pretty well by heart. It talks about in respect of a holy new... what is the Sabbath, the holy day, new moon?
Holy day, new moon, and then Sabbath.
Oh, the holy day, the new moon, and the Sabbath. Now, I had already read this, and you see, that was what got me. Because verse 14 talked about nailing to the cross. And in verse 16, there was the holy day, the new moon, and the Sabbath day. And I said, that does away with the Sabbath. I said, we know. I said, even the Adventists admit that the annual holy days are done away with. They don't observe these annual Sabbaths. So I went to the library, and I came to the word respect. I looked up every word in Colossians 2:16. And I saw that the word for respect, the original Greek word, is M-E-R-E-I. And it means part, parcel, portion, or observance of. And I looked further into commentaries. And I looked up in the different lexicons, and one lexicon said that one definition of M-E-R-E-I is sacrificial meat observance. Sacrificial meat observance.